This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The Trump campaign is planning to spend more than $1 billion, and it will be aided by a vast coalition of partisan media, outside political groups, and freelance operatives poised to wage what could be the most extensive disinformation campaign in U.S. history. Whether or not it succeeds in re-electing the president, the wreckage it leaves behind could be irreparable. That's what our guest McKay Coppins writes in his article, The 2020 Disinformation War: Deep Fakes, Anonymous Text Messages, Potemkin Local News Sites, and Opposition Research on Reporters, a Field Guide to the Year's Election and What It Could Do to the Country. It's published in the March issue of The Atlantic, where Coppins is a staff writer. While researching the piece, he tried to live in the same information world as Trump supporters, so that he'd receive the same disinformation supporters did. In his article, he explains the surprising impact that had on him. Coppins wrote a 2015 book called The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. He spoke with Terry Gross.
McKay Coppins, welcome back to Fresh Air. So what was your mission when you started this piece, trying to understand how disinformation works?
Well, I guess it came from a place of curiosity, primarily because as a political reporter, I kept encountering people either on the campaign trail or at rallies or just even in my day-to-day life who believed things that just were provably false. These weren't, you know, matters of different opinion. They weren't different ideological views. They were factual things that a lot of people seemed to believe that were not true. And, you know, as a reporter, I'm always interested in kind of the systems that lead to these views rather than kind of just interrogating individual people. So I knew, of course, that the Trump campaign was, had a shaky relationship with the truth, to put it lightly. And I knew that they were very digitally sophisticated, much more so than in 2016. And so I wanted to kind of go inside that world and see what they were doing to shape their supporters' view of the world and also to get their message out.
So to do this, you had to get on the right list. So you'd get the texts, you'd see the tweets, you'd get, you'd see the right Facebook accounts and Facebook ads. So what did you do to get on the right list?
Well, you know, it started, I just gave my cell phone number to the Trump campaign so I would get their texts, and I did a few other things. But what was most illuminating was this Facebook account that I created. I kind of sat down and built a separate profile from my own with a fake name, a kind of picture of my face obscured, and started clicking like on Donald Trump's official page and his re-election campaign's page and various other associated pages, basically signaling to Facebook that I was interested in pro-Trump content. From there, the algorithm kind of prodded me to follow various other conservative pages, conservative pundit Ann Coulter, Fox Business, fan pages for Trump. I also joined a couple of private groups on Facebook for, Trump super fans. And combined, this created a newsfeed on my Facebook account that was, you know, just filled with pro-Trump content. And I got a good sense of kind of the what the campaign was pumping out on a day-to-day basis.
Tell us some of the typical messages that you got and some of the more outrageous ones.
Well, as you can imagine, a lot of them were sort of traditional, if especially shouty and aggressive partisan messages. You know, this is a hoax. This is a witch hunt. The Democrats are out to invalidate the 2016 election. Things like that, that maybe as a political reporter I've become desensitized to, but they're not completely outside the bounds of typical messaging around an impeachment battle, frankly. I think that what I saw that was different was, first of all, the volume of the content that they're putting out on Facebook is pretty overwhelming. The way that Facebook is structured, when you're scrolling through a newsfeed, It never ends, right? It just keeps repopulating with more and more content. And as I would kind of spend time lying in bed at night or in my office scrolling through, it would almost become overwhelming. There's just this torrent of messaging and, you know, kind of propagandistic posts. And the more that you saw, the more that you kind of became desensitized to it. And some of it was partisan spin, but a lot of it, frankly, was just completely false or posts that were designed to recast the what was happening in the impeachment proceedings and make people think that something entirely different was happening.
So give us a sense of the more fictitious narratives that you were reading.
So the overall narrative that they were pushing was that President Trump was, in this Ukraine matter, primarily interested in cracking down on foreign corruption, and that Democrats were trying to use this to plot or execute a coup. This is a word that comes up over and over again. That was kind of the message that they were pushing. But throughout the impeachment proceedings, every day that there was a new witness or a new development in the case, the Trump campaign would put out these new videos or these ads that were designed to convince you almost that the opposite had happened. So there were days when I would watch the impeachment hearings live on TV, and I would see what I felt like was pretty damning testimony about the president's conduct in the Ukraine matter. And then I would check in on this Facebook feed and I would see a video that the Trump campaign had put out that took elements of that testimony, but cut them together and recast them to make it look like it was an exoneration of the president. There would also be campaign videos that made it appear that all of the witnesses in the impeachment proceedings were just offering their opinions or how they felt and that they weren't presenting any new facts, which was also clearly not true. But if you were an average Trump-supporting news consumer who wasn't following along on the impeachment proceedings day to day and just saw these videos, you would think that that was the fact. That was what was happening.
Well, you were following the impeachment proceedings. What impact did this counter-narrative, and often fictitious counter-narrative, what impact did that have on you?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I was actually pretty surprised by the effect it had, in part because I went into this exercise as a journalist knowing what I was doing, and I felt that, you know, my inherent skepticism of the Trump campaign's messaging and kind of my media literacy as somebody who's a journalist and does this professionally would kind of inoculate me against any of these distortions. But in fact, I found that I became over time reflexively suspicious of every headline I encountered. It wasn't that I believed the president and his allies were telling the truth or that their narrative was true. It was more that I had this heightened suspicion or cynicism about the all of the content surrounding the impeachment proceedings. And I started to question everything, frankly. It was almost like the truth about impeachment or the Ukraine affair or any other political issue felt difficult to find amid the rubble of kind of mangled facts and partisan spin. And the more time that I spent in this Facebook feed, the more it felt like observable reality itself had almost drifted out of reach.
It turns out there's a word for this, an expression for this. You say scholars call this censorship through noise. Explain mm-hmm. what censorship through noise is.
It's a term scholars use to describe what illiberal political leaders have done in other countries, which is, you know, in the past, the way that illiberal autocrats or dictators or whatever function is that they would do what they could to censor dissenting information. They would shut down opposition newspapers. They would jail journalists. They would cut off access to information that challenged their authority or power. And that still happens sometimes, but a lot of these illiberal leaders have discovered that in the internet age, in the social media age, in what scholars call the information abundance age, it's a lot easier to harness the power of social media for their own means. So rather than shutting down dissenting voices, they've learned to use the democratizing power of social media to jam the signals or sow confusion. They don't have to silence the dissident who's shouting in the streets. They can actually just drown him out. And I think that over time, you've seen this in other countries, certainly in the Baltic states and Eastern Europe, Russia. If journalism and facts are treated as equal in credibility to partisan propaganda or lies from political leaders, if it's all one level playing field, then it becomes almost impossible for political leaders to be held accountable for their actions, because you have a population that's either disengaged or distracted or confused and unable to kind of respond to the various corruptions and scandals and things that they're getting away with.
You say that the Trump campaign might be the most extensive disinformation campaign in U.S. history. What are some of the signs of that?
You combine the fact that this president is willing to lie and traffics in conspiracy theories and says things that are untrue at a rate that is kind of unprecedented for a president, with all of these new tools and these new technologies and social media. And what you have is a presidential campaign that is pushing lies and distortions and conspiracy theories into the bloodstream at an unprecedented rate, with tools that enable them to do it much more efficiently and effectively than any kind of demagogic leader in generations past. And that's what I mean when I say that this is going to be unprecedented. There's going to be a lot more money involved. The tools are a lot more powerful. And we have a president who has the powers of incumbency, the federal government behind him, willing to do things that most presidents have not shown a willingness to do.
So Trump has more money and more influence now to spread disinformation than he did during the 2016 campaign.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to remember, in 2016, Donald Trump, first of all, started out as one of 16 Republican presidential candidates. He was not somebody who had a large, sophisticated campaign staff. In fact, most of the people who went to work for him were kind of B-team operatives who didn't get hired by any of the other front runners early in the primaries. He also was, you know, a reality TV star. He certainly had a lot of reach because he was famous, but he wasn't the president of the United States. Now he's an incumbent. He has the ability to use and leverage his incumbency for re-election. And he's already shown a willingness to use that power in ways that are pretty brazen. You know, I talk about the 2018 midterm elections, where he actually seized on these stories about a migrant caravan traveling to the southern border from Central America and made that a central campaign issue in the final weeks of the election. And to draw attention to it, he militarized the border. He dispatched troops to the southern border. Now, I should say the president, of course, defended those actions, saying that this was all in the name of national security to keep the country protected. But within weeks after the midterms, he quietly began calling back those troops from the southern border. And so I think a lot of skeptics saw that and realized that this president has a lot of power, a willingness to use it, and if he was willing to do that just to pick up a few seats in the midterms, it begs the question what he's willing to do to win re-election.
McKay Coppins speaking with Terry Gross. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. His new article in The Atlantic is titled The 2020 Disinformation War. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break, and Justin Chang will review the film And Then We Danced, which sparked a controversy in the country of Georgia, where it's set, because of its depiction of a gay love story. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with McKay Coppins, whose new article, The 2020 Disinformation War, is in the current issue of The Atlantic, where he's a staff writer. He writes about how the Trump campaign and a vast coalition of partisan media, outside political groups, and freelance operatives are poised to wage what could be the most extensive disinformation campaign in U.S. history. As part of his research, Coppins tried to live in the same media and social media world as Trump supporters so he could monitor the information or disinformation they were receiving.
So we've been talking about how the Trump campaign is using social media and using it in part to sow disinformation. The person presiding over the Trump campaign digital effort is Brad Pascal, who was also the digital director of Trump's 2016 campaign. What are some of the techniques that you think he came up with?
One of the things that he got really good at was using Facebook ads, and particularly micro-targeted Facebook ads, to raise money and fire up the faithful and target persuadable voters. And so micro-targeting is the process of basically you take the electorate, you slice it up into very small, distinct, specific niches, and then you create ads that speak directly to those niches. And Facebook allows campaigns to create these ads and serve them to very small groups.
And the Republican Party has information on just about every voter to help them figure out who to target.
Yeah, it's been reported that the RNC and the Trump campaign have compiled an average of 3,000 data points on every voter in America. So that means everything from what you like to watch on TV, what kind of stores you shop at, whether you've been to a gun show or own a gun. They've compiled all this data, and they can use it to carefully tailor messages just for you. And I should say that this is not unique to the Trump campaign. This isn't something Brad Parscale invented. Barack Obama's campaign famously did it in 2012. The Clinton campaign did it as well in 2016. But the Trump campaign's effort was different, both because it was much more extensive and also, frankly, a lot more brazen. One example I give in the piece is in 2016, the Trump campaign, in the final weeks of the race, tried to depress black turnout in Florida by micro-targeting ads to black voters in that state that said, Hillary thinks African Americans are super predators. So drawing from that famous controversial comment that Clinton had made in the 90s, but obviously taking it out of context and generalizing it a bit more than I think the average fact checker would say is okay. They micro-targeted these to black voters, not even really to win them over or get them to vote for Trump, but to keep them away from the polls. And we only know about that specific case because a Trump campaign official boasted about it at the time and said this is one of three major voter suppression efforts that we have that are underway. But the campaign puts out so many Facebook ads that it's really difficult for journalists or watchdog groups to wade through all of them. Just as an example, in the 10 weeks after the impeachment proceedings began, the Trump campaign ran 14,000 ads on Facebook containing the word impeachment.
Mark Zuckerberg is allowing candidates to place false political ads. He's decided Facebook should not have editorial control over that. How does that compare with commercial ads on Facebook?
Yeah, this is a very important point, because when a company places an ad on Facebook, it is subject to fact checking. It's not allowed to say obviously false things about its product. And if it does, Facebook will remove that ad and punish that client. That is not true of political ads. Mark Zuckerberg came under a lot of pressure after the 2016 election to crack down on the spread of misinformation on his platform. And he rolled out a flurry of reforms, but in the end decided that it was not their place to prevent political ads that are dishonest or even just completely unfactual. He believes that because political ads receive a lot of scrutiny already from the press and from opposition parties and from watchdogs, that it's not Facebook's role to censor them, that he lets politicians put out whatever ads they want and lets kind of the electorate decide whether they're true or not.
It sounds like during this campaign that the Trump campaign is emphasizing texting more than it did in 2016, and you were receiving Trump campaign texts. How is the texting platform seen as a particularly good one for the campaign?
Yeah, and I bet a lot of your listeners have experienced this. You know, there's been a huge uptick in unsolicited political text messages this campaign season, and there's a reason for that. So until pretty recently, you had to opt in to receive mass text messages from politicians or campaigns. But there are these new apps called peer-to-peer texting apps that allow people, volunteers, campaign staffers, whoever, to send hundreds of messages an hour. They just literally have to sit there and press click over and over and over again. And that's considered by the FCC to be not mass texting, but one-on-one texting. And so a lot of campaigns have taken advantage of this loophole and begun using these peer-to-peer texting apps to send out messages to millions of people unsolicited. The Trump campaign has gone in on this strategy much more than other campaigns have. That's in part because one of their senior officials, Gary Kobe, developed one of these peer-to-peer texting apps. But the reason that they're seen as so valuable is because, unlike robocalls that get sent to voicemail or email blasts that get ignored or trapped in spam folders, these peer-to-peer texting companies say that at least 90% of their messages are opened. And so this is a very effective way to reach a lot of voters.
The question has been raised, if Republicans are using dirty tricks, and especially dirty tricks in the digital sphere, does that mean in order to win that Democrats have to do that too?
This is an active debate among Democratic strategists right now. There are some who say this is precisely the wrong time for Democrats to abandon their principles of fairness and honesty, and that we need to be the party of truth and honesty. But there are others who have argued pretty forcefully and pretty transparently that the only way to contend with the president's reelection effort is to co-opt his tactics and improve upon them. There's one guy, Dimitri Melhorn, who's a Democratic consultant, who's kind of notorious for experimenting with digital dirty tricks. During the Alabama special election in 2017, he helped fund two different false flag operations against Roy Moore. You remember the Republican Senate candidate. In one scheme, faux Russian Twitter bots actually followed the candidate's account en masse to make it look like Russia was backing Moore. And in another, there was a social media campaign dubbed Dry Alabama that was designed to make it look like Moore had the support of Baptist teetotalers who wanted to ban alcohol. And it was all fictional. I should note that Melhorn has actually said he was unaware of these efforts, doesn't support the use of the misinformation, but his group did help fund them. And more broadly, there are Democrats that are pointing to these efforts and say, we need to do more of that and do it on a much bigger scale if we're going to defeat Trump.
What's your reaction to that?
You know, as a journalist, my bias is strongly toward truth and accuracy, and I have a lot of concern about what will happen to our information ecosystem if the Democrats decide to escalate and mimic the tactics that President Trump and his allies are undertaking. I think that right now, my biggest concern going forward after the 2020 election is not really who wins, which party wins, who comes away with power in the short term. It's what happens to our information ecosystem now. If we get to a situation where Democrats and Republicans have both fully bought into the idea that truth is irrelevant, that advancing disinformation is the only way to win an election, we'll end up in a situation that a lot of other countries have found themselves in, where the average voter on a day-to-day basis has no idea what is true in the news, what to believe, and generally disengages and just throws up their hands. And that, I think, is a very dangerous situation for our democracy.
McKay Coppins, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
McKay Coppins is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His new article is titled The 2020 Disinformation War. He spoke with Terry Gross. The movie And Then We Danced sparked controversy in the country of Georgia, where it's set, because of its depiction of a gay love story. Its 2019 opening was met with violent protests from the right and an outcry from conservative politicians and the Orthodox Church. The movie was directed by a 40-year-old Swedish filmmaker whose roots are in Georgia. It was submitted by Sweden for consideration for an Oscar for Best International Feature. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
If you're like me and know nothing about the art of traditional Georgian folk dance, And Then We Danced will provide an absorbing introduction. Set in the present day in the Georgian capital of Tbilisi, the movie stars a terrific first-time actor named Levan Gelbakiani as Mehrab, a 20-something junior member of the country's national dance ensemble. In the very first scene, Mehrab, a lean young man with a broad elfin grin, rehearses with his partner, Mary, and the camera follows their bodies as they move with impressive athleticism through a tightly choreographed routine. But their instructor stops them and sternly criticizes Mehrab, saying his body is too soft when it should be as hard as a nail. Also, apparently, the dancer's eyes are much too playful. They should be gazing at the floor so as to convey a kind of virginal innocence. After all, the instructor reminds them, there is no sex in Georgian dance. The movie will soon undermine that sentiment. But although Mehrab and Mary have been dance partners for years and are nominally a couple, Mehrab shows little romantic interest in her. It soon becomes clear that he has eyes only for Irakli, a handsome young man played by Bachi Valishvili, who has recently joined their dance troupe. Irakli has a tall, muscular frame and turns out to be a more seasoned dancer than Mehrab. But the two men become friends, and as Irakli gives Mehrab helpful tips on his dancing technique, any sense of rivalry is soon eclipsed by the intensity of their shared attraction. And Then We Danced is a fairly straightforward drama of first love and sexual awakening that may remind you of exquisite gay romances like Call Me By Your Name and the underseen English film God's Own Country. But if the dramatic beats follow a familiar, even formulaic groove, it's still an engrossing story, thanks to the vividness and specificity of its Georgian setting and the beauty and vitality of the actors. Levan Akin, a Swedish-born writer-director of Georgian background, is very good at capturing those moments when friendship becomes flirtation, even with a moment as tender as Irakli resting his head on Mehrab's shoulder as the two ride a bus together. The scenes of the two men rehearsing and at one point dancing together quickly take on an undeniable erotic charge. Mehrab and Irakli are forced to carry on their relationship in secret. It's during a weekend getaway with friends that the two have sex for the first time in a secluded area outdoors, away from prying eyes. But Mary is hurt by Mehrab's neglect, and as she begins to realize what's going on, she feels both understandably betrayed and fearful for Mehrab's future. Homosexuality is legal, but homophobia is rampant in Georgia, where much of the population is Orthodox Christian. At one point, we hear background gossip about a male dancer who was caught sleeping with another man and sent to a monastery, where he was sexually assaulted by priests. That sad story is one of many that director Akin actually heard while researching his film, which he shot under difficult conditions and with tight security. The fact that the plot involved a gay love story had to be kept secret so as to avoid backlash or protests. For all those challenges, And Then We Danced is seamlessly well made, and its portrait of present-day Tbilisi conveys a striking sense of place. We get an intimate look at Mehrab's life at home, and also at the challenges and limited opportunities that face many working-class youth. Family obligations force Irakli to shuttle between Tbilisi and Batumi, a city hundreds of miles away. Mehrab divides his time between dancing and working as a restaurant waiter. His parents were once dancers themselves, but never managed to do it for a living. Even his ne'er-do-well older brother is a dancer, although he gets drunk every night and often misses practice the next morning. Dance clearly exerts a powerful grip on the culture, and its unyielding standards of masculinity serve as an effective metaphor for a society mired in years of conservative tradition. But the best moments in And Then We Danced suggest that dance can also be liberating. There's a wonderful scene when the two young men are alone, and a shirtless Mehrab dances for Irakli, while Honey, a popular song by the Swedish artist Robin, fills the soundtrack. It's quite a moment, playful, seductive, and quietly subversive. We're reminded that dance isn't just a rigid display of national pride, but perhaps the body's most intuitive expression of love and desire.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with McKay Coppins, whose new article, The 2020 Disinformation War, is in the current issue of The Atlantic, where he's a staff writer. He writes about how the Trump campaign and a vast coalition of partisan media, outside political groups, and freelance operatives are poised to wage what could be the most extensive disinformation campaign in U.S. history. As part of his research, Coppins tried to live in the same media and social media world as Trump supporters so he could monitor the information or disinformation they were receiving.
So we've been talking about how the Trump campaign is using social media and using it in part to sow disinformation. The person presiding over the Trump campaign digital effort is Brad Pascal, who was also the digital director of Trump's 2016 campaign. What are some of the techniques that you think he came up with?
One of the things that he got really good at was using Facebook ads, and particularly micro-targeted Facebook ads, to raise money and fire up the faithful and target persuadable voters. And so micro-targeting is the process of basically you take the electorate, you slice it up into very small, distinct, specific niches, and then you create ads that speak directly to those niches. And Facebook allows campaigns to create these ads and serve them to very small groups.
And the Republican Party has information on just about every voter to help them figure out who to target.
Yeah, it's been reported that the RNC and the Trump campaign have compiled an average of 3,000 data points on every voter in America. So that means everything from what you like to watch on TV, what kind of stores you shop at, whether you've been to a gun show or own a gun. They've compiled all this data, and they can use it to carefully tailor messages just for you. And I should say that this is not unique to the Trump campaign. This isn't something Brad Pascal invented. Barack Obama's campaign famously did it in 2012. The Clinton campaign did it as well in 2016. But the Trump campaign's effort was different, both because it was much more extensive and also, frankly, a lot more brazen. One example I give in the piece is in 2016, the Trump campaign, in the final weeks of the race, tried to depress black turnout in Florida by micro-targeting ads to black voters in that state that said, Hillary thinks African Americans are super predators. So drawing from that famous controversial comment that Clinton had made in the 90s, but obviously taking it out of context and generalizing it a bit more than I think the average fact checker would say is okay. They micro-targeted these two black voters, not even really to win them over or get them to vote for Trump, but to keep them away from the polls. And we only know about that specific case because a Trump campaign official boasted about it at the time and said this is one of three major voter suppression efforts that we have that are underway. But the campaign puts out so many Facebook ads that it's really difficult for journalists or watchdog groups to wade through all of them. Just as an example, in the 10 weeks after the impeachment proceedings began, the Trump campaign ran 14,000 ads on Facebook containing the word impeachment.
Mark Zuckerberg is allowing candidates to place false political ads. He's decided Facebook should not have editorial control over that. How does that compare with commercial ads on Facebook?
Yeah, this is a very important point because when a company places an ad on Facebook, it is subject to fact-checking. It's not allowed to say obviously false things about its product. And if it does, Facebook will remove that ad and punish that client. That is not true of political ads. Mark Zuckerberg came under a lot of pressure after the 2016 election to crack down on the spread of misinformation on his platform. And he rolled out a flurry of reforms, but in the end decided that it was not their place to prevent political ads that are dishonest or even just completely unfactual. He believes that because political ads receive a lot of scrutiny already from the press and from opposition parties and from watchdogs, that it's not Facebook's role to censor them, that he lets politicians put out whatever ads they want and lets kind of the electorate decide whether they're true or not.
It sounds like during this campaign that the Trump campaign is emphasizing texting more than it did in 2016, and you were receiving Trump campaign texts. How is the texting platform seen as a particularly good one for the campaign?
Yeah, and I bet a lot of your listeners have experienced this. You know, there's been a huge uptick in unsolicited political text messages this campaign season, and there's a reason for that. So until pretty recently, you had to opt in to receive mass text messages from politicians or campaigns. But there are these new apps called peer-to-peer texting apps that allow people, volunteers, campaign staffers, whoever, to send hundreds of messages an hour. They just literally have to sit there and press click over and over and over again. And that's considered by the FCC to be not mass texting, but one-on-one texting. And so a lot of campaigns have taken advantage of this loophole and begun using these peer-to-peer texting apps to send out messages to millions of people unsolicited. The Trump campaign has gone in on this strategy much more than other campaigns have. That's in part because one of their senior officials, Gary Kobe, developed one of these peer-to-peer texting apps. But the reason that they're seen as so valuable is because unlike robocalls that get sent to voicemail or email blasts that get ignored or trapped in spam folders, these peer-to-peer texting companies say that at least 90% of their messages are opened. And so this is a very effective way to reach a lot of voters.
The question has been raised, if Republicans are using dirty tricks, and especially dirty tricks in the digital sphere, does that mean in order to win that Democrats have to do that too?
This is an active debate among Democratic strategists right now. There are some who say this is precisely the wrong time for Democrats to abandon their principles of fairness and honesty, and that we need to be the party of truth and honesty. But there are others who have argued pretty forcefully and pretty transparently that the only way to contend with the president's reelection effort is to co-opt his tactics and improve upon them. There's one guy, Dimitri Melhorn, who's a Democratic consultant, who's kind of notorious for experimenting with digital dirty tricks. During the Alabama special election in 2017, he helped fund two different false flag operations against Roy Moore. You remember the Republican Senate candidate. In one scheme, faux Russian Twitter bots actually followed the candidate's account en masse to make it look like Russia was backing Moore. And in another, there was a social media campaign dubbed Dry Alabama that was designed to make it look like Moore had the support of Baptist teetotalers who wanted to ban alcohol. And it was all fictional. I should note that Melhorn has actually said he was unaware of these efforts, doesn't support the use of the misinformation, but his group did help fund them. And more broadly, there are Democrats that are pointing to these efforts and say, we need to do more of that and do it on a much bigger scale if we're going to defeat Trump.
What's your reaction to that?
You know, as a journalist, my bias is strongly toward truth and accuracy, and I have a lot of concern about what will happen to our information ecosystem if the Democrats decide to escalate and mimic the tactics that President Trump and his allies are undertaking. I think that right now, my biggest concern going forward after the 2020 election is not really who wins, which party wins, who comes away with power in the short term. It's what happens to our information ecosystem now. If we get to a situation where Democrats and Republicans have both fully bought into the idea that truth is irrelevant, that advancing disinformation is the only way to win an election, we'll end up in a situation that a lot of other countries have found themselves in, where the average voter on a day-to-day basis has no idea what is true in the news, what to believe, and generally disengages and just throws up their hands. And that, I think, is a very dangerous situation for our democracy.
McKay Coppins, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
McKay Coppins is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His new article is titled The 2020 Disinformation War. He spoke with Terry Gross. The movie And Then We Danced sparked controversy in the country of Georgia, where it's set, because of its depiction of a gay love story. Its 2019 opening was met with violent protests from the right and an outcry from conservative politicians and the Orthodox Church. The movie was directed by a 40-year-old Swedish filmmaker whose roots are in Georgia. It was submitted by Sweden for consideration for an Oscar for Best International Feature. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
If you're like me and know nothing about the art of traditional Georgian folk dance, And Then We Danced will provide an absorbing introduction. Set in the present day in the Georgian capital of Tbilisi, the movie stars a terrific first-time actor named Levan Gelbakiani as Mehrab, a 20-something junior member of the country's national dance ensemble. In the very first scene, Mehrab, a lean young man with a broad elfin grin, rehearses with his partner, Mary, and the camera follows their bodies as they move with impressive athleticism through a tightly choreographed routine. But their instructor stops them and sternly criticizes Mehrab, saying his body is too soft when it should be as hard as a nail. Also, apparently, the dancer's eyes are much too playful. They should be gazing at the floor so as to convey a kind of virginal innocence. After all, the instructor reminds them, there is no sex in Georgian dance. The movie will soon undermine that sentiment. But although Mehrab and Mary have been dance partners for years and are nominally a couple, Mehrab shows little romantic interest in her. It soon becomes clear that he has eyes only for Irakli, a handsome young man played by Bachi Valishvili, who has recently joined their dance troupe. Irakli has a tall, muscular frame and turns out to be a more seasoned dancer than Mehrab. But the two men become friends, and as Irakli gives Mehrab helpful tips on his dancing technique, any sense of rivalry is soon eclipsed by the intensity of their shared attraction. And Then We Danced is a fairly straightforward drama of first love and sexual awakening that may remind you of exquisite gay romances like Call Me By Your Name and the underseen English film God's Own Country. But if the dramatic beats follow a familiar, even formulaic groove, it's still an engrossing story, thanks to the vividness and specificity of its Georgian setting and the beauty and vitality of the actors. Levan Akin, a Swedish-born writer-director of Georgian background, is very good at capturing those moments when friendship becomes flirtation, even with a moment as tender as Irakli resting his head on Mehrab's shoulder as the two ride a bus together. The scenes of the two men rehearsing and at one point dancing together quickly take on an undeniable erotic charge. Mehrab and Irakli are forced to carry on their relationship in secret. It's during a weekend getaway with friends that the two have sex for the first time in a secluded area outdoors, away from prying eyes. But Mary is hurt by Mehrab's neglect, and as she begins to realize what's going on, she feels both understandably betrayed and fearful for Mehrab's future. Homosexuality is legal, but homophobia is rampant in Georgia, where much of the population is Orthodox Christian. At one point, we hear background gossip about a male dancer who was caught sleeping with another man and sent to a monastery, where he was sexually assaulted by priests. That sad story is one of many that director Akin actually heard while researching his film, which he shot under difficult conditions and with tight security. The fact that the plot involved a gay love story had to be kept secret so as to avoid backlash or protests. For all those challenges, And Then We Danced is seamlessly well made, and its portrait of present-day Tbilisi conveys a striking sense of place. we get an intimate look at Mehrab's life at home and also at the challenges and limited opportunities that face many working-class youth. Family obligations force Irakli to shuttle between Tbilisi and Batumi, a city hundreds of miles away. Mehrab divides his time between dancing and working as a restaurant waiter. His parents were once dancers themselves, but never managed to do it for a living. Even his ne'er-do-well older brother is a dancer, although he gets drunk every night and often misses practice the next morning. Dance clearly exerts a powerful grip on the culture, and its unyielding standards of masculinity serve as an effective metaphor for a society mired in years of conservative tradition. But the best moments in And Then We Danced suggest that dance can also be liberating. There's a wonderful scene when the two young men are alone, and a shirtless Mehrab dances for Irakli, while Honey, a popular song by the Swedish artist Robin, fills the soundtrack. It's quite a moment, playful, seductive, and quietly subversive. We're reminded that dance isn't just a rigid display of national pride, but perhaps the body's most intuitive expression of love and desire.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, we'll hear from Michael Pollan, who's written best-selling books about the origins of the food we eat and how psychedelics are helping scientists understand consciousness and the brain. He has a new audio book about caffeine and its effect on the mind and body. This is Fresh Air Week.